is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump orders thousands of troops to be sent home from the Middle East.
You do not normally see outgoing presidents making troop adjustments in the final days of their presidency.
African countries prepare for a smaller wave as the coronavirus rages across the United States. Also ahead, country singer Leanne Rimes turns to chants to relieve the pandemic blues. It's all on today's The orders of President Donald Trump, the Pentagon Tuesday said it is bringing home more than 2,000 American service members from Iraq and Afghanistan in the coming weeks ahead of next year's U.S. presidential inauguration. Joining us for the latest is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, what can you tell us about this announcement?
By January the 15th, the U.S. is going to reduce its force presence in Afghanistan to 2,500 troops. It's at about 4,500 now. It's also going to be reducing its forces in Iraq to 2,500 troops by January 15th as well. That's according to Acting Secretary of Defense Chris Miller. He was talking to Pentagon reporters Tuesday. We went in the briefing room. We were hoping to ask him some questions, but he did not take any questions. He just made this statement. He told us that while this is a troop reduction, it did not equate to a change in U.S. policy or objectives in the global war against terrorism. And I will point out that National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien did lay out a similar plan to this reduction in October. And at the time, the Pentagon would not confirm or deny his plan that he had laid out. But now we see that this is happening.
Why is it significant? And is it significant?
So the significance in this is, number one, you do not normally see outgoing presidents making troop adjustments in the final days of their presidency. That is usually something that they try to keep consistent so the incoming president can make the decision on that. That's the number one issue. Another thing that's significant about this is the U.S. is not going to zero troops. That was something that had been a major concern for former military officials, current military officials, experts, because they worried that if the U.S. would go down to zero troops in Afghanistan, that we would not have completed our objectives being preventing another 9/11, not allowing al-Qaeda to have a safe haven there, and helping the Afghan government and the Taliban reach a peace agreement. And so now we know that that will not happen by the time that President Trump exits on January the 20th. Miller was able to speak, he said, with several key leaders to update them on the plans. But the interesting thing, he said, he spoke to them Tuesday, which was when the news came out. And so it appears that our allies and the members of Congress did not have a lot of notice on this change. He notified NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. And while a senior defense official told reporters on background that these cuts are not going to result in any elimination of capabilities on the ground, current U.S. military officials have told me on background that any significant reduction of forces like the one that's happening in Afghanistan is going to lead to at least some reduction of the scope of U.S. missions. And that is if indeed all of the missions in Afghanistan continue. In fact, one official told me that the U.S. military is currently still working through the detailed planning to determine what effect exactly this reduction is going to have on particular capabilities, be they training and advising the Afghan forces or something like counterterrorism.
What impact could this have with ongoing negotiations with the Taliban in the upcoming Biden administration, and what reaction are you hearing?
We're not yet sure what the reaction will be, but we do know that people on Capitol Hill are thinking this is not a good move. In fact, Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger told VOA on Tuesday that any sort of drawdown like this is a mistake that would destroy any leverage that the U.S. could be using in peace negotiations designed to end the fighting between the Afghan government and the Taliban. In fact, he said, these negotiations are still ongoing. You always negotiate from a position of strength, implying that reducing by 2,000 forces roughly would not be from a position of strength at all. We also have heard from some of President Trump's biggest allies on Capitol Hill. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has said that the U.S. needs to continue to apply pressure until conditions for a long-term defeat of Islamic State and al-Qaeda have been achieved. He said, frankly, no American wants to continue this war in Afghanistan. They would like it to be conclusively won, but the facts on the ground are that, and I'm paraphrasing here, but a rapid withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan would hurt our allies and delight the people who wish us harm.
And why do you think this is happening now?
Well, President Trump abruptly fired Defense Secretary Mark Esper about a week ago, and he replaced him with Christopher Miller, the former director of the National Counterterrorism Center. And then after Miller was appointed, there were additional appointees at the Pentagon, one being retired Army Colonel Douglas McGregor, who's called frequently for a complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan and even the shutting down of the U.S. embassy in Kabul, and Anthony Tata, who is now performing the duties of Undersecretary of Policy. He has also called for a full withdrawal from Afghanistan. So I was talking to a former senior military official who basically said the conspiracy theorist in him would have to say that now we understand why the president purged the civilian leadership at the Pentagon, because he wanted to make a big change in Afghanistan, and it appears that Secretary Esper was not willing to do so. According to the Washington Post, he had sent a memo saying that any further withdrawal was not responsible at this time.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, thanks so much.
Also on Tuesday, President Donald Trump fired the director of the country's cybersecurity agency via Twitter. The president said on Twitter that Charles Krebs' statement that the November 3rd election had been secure was highly inaccurate. Trump and his supporters have alleged there was widespread fraud in the voting. His campaign has filed numerous lawsuits in several state races that he lost narrowly to the projected winner, Joe Biden. However, the majority of those lawsuits have failed to gain traction in the courts. Krebs, a Trump appointee, was the first director of cybersecurity and infrastructure agency, which was created after U.S. intelligence agencies determined the Russian government had made significant efforts to interfere in the 2016 election. He had garnered significant support from state and federal officials for his efforts to protect the integrity of this year's election. The U.S. election won't be officially certified for weeks, and recounts are going on in the state of Georgia and other areas. Trump and his supporters have said they intend to continue pursuing legal challenges. Coronavirus cases in the U.S. now exceed 11.2 million, according to Johns Hopkins University, with 1 million of those cases recorded just in the last week. As VOA's Mariama Diallo reports, states and cities are implementing more restrictions to help fight the rising wave of new cases.
States and cities across America are ordering and imploring residents to stay home just ahead of the National Thanksgiving Day holiday next week. Chicago's mayor has asked residents to restrict gathering to 10 people or fewer. The new measure began on Monday and will last for at least a month. Chicago resident and retired doctor Forrest Jones supports the move.
I don't think we have any choice, unfortunately. As long as the numbers of new infections and deaths are going up and the stress on our capacity to care for people who get sick from COVID, this is an emergency and we have to take emergency measures.
New restrictions in the city of Philadelphia will start on Friday and extend through the end of the year.
We will prohibit indoor gatherings or events of any size in any location, public or private. It means no indoor parties, group meals, football watching groups, no visiting between households, no indoor weddings, funerals, baby showers.
Washington Governor Jay Inslee warned his state is facing its most dangerous virus threat yet.
Now we're facing a third wave that is trending to be more dangerous than any we have seen before. Average daily cases in our state have doubled just in the last 2 weeks. It cannot go on like this.
Starting Tuesday, gyms and some entertainment centers in Washington state will be required to halt indoor services. And restaurants and bars will again be limited to outdoor dining and takeout services starting on Wednesday. Also Wednesday, Michigan will begin new restrictions for at least 3 weeks, including no in-person classes for high schools and colleges, no organized sports, and no indoor dining.
We are in the worst moment of this pandemic to date. The situation has never been more dire. We are at the precipice and we need to take some action.
Some good news came on Monday in the form of a second promising COVID vaccine. Drug maker Moderna said preliminary results found its vaccine to be 94.5% effective, but company officials say there's still a lot of work ahead.
It's a really important milestone in the fight against the pandemic. Knowing the vaccine is going to be effective is great news, but we still need to complete the regulatory process, which involves completing the study and generating more data, even some follow-up and safety data. And then, of course, we need to get busy manufacturing.
1 week ago, drug maker Pfizer said a trial study found its vaccine to be 90% effective against COVID-19. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
As COVID-19 infections soar in the United States, the African continent is bracing for a smaller surge after spending the year defying predictions that it would be the hardest hit. Medical experts, including U.S. Infectious Disease Chief Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. John Kengasong, Director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, are meeting virtually this week to discuss what the very different areas have learned from the pandemic. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Egypt discovered its first coronavirus case in February, African public health officials sprang into action. A week later, experts from the African Union's 55 member states convened at AU headquarters in Addis Ababa to come up with a plan. 9 months later, Africa's top health leader says that coordinated response spared the continent the worst of the pandemic, with 1.9 million recorded cases, fewer than expected for a continent with such low levels of infrastructure and social safety nets. And says Dr. John Kengasong, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it is proof that this continent is more than capable of battling a pandemic that has overwhelmed other societies.
The key in the fine leadership of the continent very early on in February has been a very critical factor in moderating the spread of the virus on the continent. As a matter of fact, if the continent didn't go into a massive shutdown early on in March, with the rates in South Africa, for example, were doubling every 2 days, I think that would have been a severe pandemic in South Africa.
And Kengasong says the pandemic proves that partnerships matter and that a cooperative, coordinated approach is necessary to contain the spread of the virus. Dr. Anthony Fauci heads the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in the country hit hardest by the pandemic, the United States. Fauci, speaking to medical experts by video conference late Monday, reiterated the 5 steps everyone must take to avoid the coronavirus. Wear a mask. Keep a 2-meter distance from others. Avoid crowds. Conduct any gatherings outdoors instead of indoors, and regularly wash hands.
If those 5 public health measures were adhered to universally and consistently over the country, it is clear from our previous experience with other nations and even regions in our own country, we would not be having the degree of surging of cases that we are currently seeing.
In some U.S. states, political leaders have embraced those measures. In others, governors have contested the importance of masks or declined to impose restrictions they say would hurt businesses. Fauci said the result is a surge in cases across the U.S.
Around June 19th, we had the beginning of a resurgence of cases due to the attempts to so-called reopen the economy or reopen the country, which was done variably with regard to adhering to the guidelines which came out. Different states did it differently. And we had a resurgence back up to close to 70,000, went back down, stayed around 40,000 for a while, and now is going up to 86,000 with a mean, I say, an average of weekly somewhere around 80,000. Unfortunately, on November the 4th, we hit 100,000 cases in a single day.
According to the Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. currently has more than 11 million confirmed cases and approaching 250,000 deaths. Meanwhile, Nkengasong notes that Africa's leaders are pushing the prevention measures anew as the continent braces for another coronavirus wave that seems to be emerging, concentrated in Algeria, Tunisia, Kenya, and South Africa.
There's a tale, a very worrying tale is beginning to emerge, and we are recording now about 10,000 cases per day. And you're very clearly showing that if not, something is not done, we'll be getting a second peak sooner than later.
He said, if Africans stick together, in spirit, not physically, the continent will show the world it can beat the virus. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke with Joe Biden on Tuesday for the first time since his victory in the U.S. election. Netanyahu, a close ally of Trump, congratulated Biden via Twitter after the election was called, but has avoided commenting on the results. Israelis have welcomed Trump's maximum pressure campaign against Iran and his unprecedented support for Israel in the conflict with the Palestinians. Biden's plans to return to the Iran nuclear agreement and press for the revival of the Mideast peace process could set him on a collision course with Netanyahu, who had icy relations with the Obama administration. Also Tuesday, the Palestinian Authority said it is restoring ties with Israel that it had severed in May over Israel's planned annexation of parts of the occupied West Bank. Joining us now for more on all of this is Daniel Sokatch, CEO of the New Israel Fund. Thank you for being with us. So let's start with the phone call. Why was Netanyahu's phone call to Biden so significant?
Prime Minister Netanyahu waited a good half a day or so before reaching out to congratulate President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris after the election was called on Saturday a couple weeks ago. But he didn't refer to them by those titles then. On Tuesday, Prime Minister reached out again, as did the President of Israel, Ruvi Rivlin, to congratulate officially. The President congratulated President-elect Biden, affirmed the relationship between the two countries, and the Prime Minister phoned Mr. Biden and also, as being reported, referred to him publicly for the first time as President-elect, which is, of course, significant insofar as this has become a matter of contention in the United States when it actually, of course, shouldn't be.
And of course, you know, he has had a very strong relationship with President Trump. What do you think is so significant beyond the fact that he actually acknowledged the title of President-elect?
It is significant because it does show the extent to which the rest of the world understands exactly what's happening here. But it's also important from the Israel-America perspective. Israel traditionally has been a priority and concern for Democrats and Republicans alike. There are many reasons why it is now perceived more and more as a partisan Republican issue.
Are you saying that this could potentially be a signal from Netanyahu that he wants warmer ties with President-elect Biden than he had with the Obama administration?
Yeah, look, I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu understands that the free ride with President Trump is coming to an end. He likes to say that President Trump was the best president in history for Israel. Now, of course, facing a Biden administration, Netanyahu is intent on trying to do some repair in making Israel less of a bipartisan issue than it has been at any point since the birth of the state in 1948.
We also learned on Tuesday that the Palestinians have restored ties with Israel following the election. What does that actually mean in concrete terms?
What it means is that some of the security cooperation, most importantly, that the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis have relied on since the Oslo era in the mid-90s, which was formally called off by the PA after the Israeli peace deals with the Gulf states, facilitated by Mr. Netanyahu and a few other things that caused ruptures in those relationships, is now officially back on track. And that's incredibly significant for a lot of reasons. First of all, because the Israelis, the IDF, relies on PA security forces to work with them to prevent terrorism. And frankly, in this moment of COVID, it's an illusion to think that the pandemic is going to respect boundaries and borders. Of course, it doesn't. The boundaries and borders between the West Bank and Israel are incredibly porous, both because Israel has settled almost 700,000 of its citizens over the Green Line in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, territory that it captured in the 1967 war, and because there is a lot of back and forth between Israelis and Palestinians. And so the idea that Israel alone or the Palestinian Authority alone can take the kinds of actions and measures that are required to fight the pandemic in isolation from one another is absurd. And so this now is significant, not only because it officially restores the security cooperation, but because it allows the PA and Israel to coordinate in fighting the pandemic. And Israeli analysts are suggesting that the room created for the PA by the election of Biden and the end of the Trump administration, which the PA saw as completely partisan towards Israel and abandoning the traditional sort of neutral arbiter role that American administrations have liked to claim that they play, that this return to something that seems more like the U.S. role of previous decades, whether in a Republican or Democratic administration, gives the PA room to make this move to get back into security cooperation with Israel.
Daniel Sokatch, CEO of New Israel Fund, thanks so much for being with us. People in Central America and aid agencies lining up to help them are bracing for the potentially catastrophic consequences of Hurricane Iota just weeks after Hurricane Eta made landfall in the region with devastating impacts. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
People in Central America and aid agencies lining up to help them are bracing for the potentially catastrophic consequences of Hurricane Iota just 2 weeks after Hurricane Eta made landfall in the region with devastating effect. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. Iota is the strongest Atlantic storm to make landfall in Central America this season. It hit with thundering force just 2 weeks after Hurricane Eta made landfall in the region, causing death and destruction and affecting nearly 5 million people. World Meteorological Organization spokeswoman Claire Nullis says for the first time on record, the Atlantic has had two major hurricanes in November, a time of year when the season is normally winding down.
Nicaragua, Honduras, other parts of Central America have not recovered from Hurricane Eta, and now they're being slammed by this new, terrific, powerful hurricane. The rainfall impacts, the risk of mudslides, landslides, and you know, the threat to life and property remains very, very, very high.
In anticipation of Hurricane Iota, International Red Cross Federation volunteers have been pre-positioning basic relief items in Nicaragua. IFRC spokesman Matthew Cochran says Nicaragua is at risk of landslides in addition to heavy flooding and wind damage.
In Honduras, the Red Cross has pre-positioned rescue boats in the south and the north of the country in anticipation of launching major search and rescue operations once the storm passes. The Red Cross was also involved in preventative evacuations using helicopters over the past few days.
Spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, tells VOA it is too soon to know the extent of damage caused by Iota. But he says the impact is likely to be worse than that from Hurricane Eta, which is growing in severity.
So, for example, Honduras authorities now report that 3 million people are affected. That's 1 million more than the figures that they reported last week. In Guatemala, we are talking about more than 900,000 people directly affected by Eta. That's nearly triple the figure from the previous weeks.
Lajerke says Eta is still a developing emergency made far worse by another emergency, Hurricane Iota, with potentially catastrophic consequences. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bongo flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to Ndumbulu and Makosa to Kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
VOA's International Edition continues. For months, thousands of Americans protested against police brutality and called for police reform. But now, support for Black Lives Matter seems to have cooled, according to a recent survey. We hear more now from VOA's Elizabeth Lee.
It has been months since demonstrations across the U.S. prompted by the death of George Floyd, a black man who died while in police custody. In a country with a decentralized law enforcement, some changes at the local level have taken place, says Scott Roberts with Color of Change.
We've seen activists electing
more reform-oriented prosecutors all around the country.
But support for the Black Lives Matter movement has cooled since June. A recent Pew Research Center survey finds 55% of American adults express some support for the movement, compared to 67% in June during the height of the protests. But the support among Asians and Black Americans has remained largely unchanged. Some 87% of African Americans say they support the movement.
Priority for me and for Color of Change is reducing the size and scope of policing.
Robert says police are being asked to do things that are not their role, such as answering mental health calls.
I mean, we're talking about sending trained professionals, people who are used to dealing with that.
But people who are mentally unstable can quickly turn violent, says Betsy Smith of the National Police Association.
If we sent in the uniformed mental health workers first, you know, they would probably get hurt.
Smith says training mental health workers to deal with potentially violent situations would take funding.
I have been in the middle of budget cuts just when things go bad in your own community. And you know what goes first is all the community policing programs. And you know what goes second? All the ancillary training.
In a police executive research forum survey of U.S. police departments, close to half are expecting a decrease in department budgets, says the think tank's Chuck Wexler.
Big places like New York would lose $1 billion.
The Los Angeles police lost $150 million of its budget. Even with the push to defund the police, a Gallup poll finds 81% of Black Americans in June and July want the same or more police presence where they live. Again, Betsy Smith.
You can't take funding away from your police department and then expect to have low crime.
Wexler is a proponent of education.
To me, the answer is, you know, not defunding per se, but investing. There can be what we talk about is the need to radically blow up training and think about it differently.
Criminality is not race-based. Black people are about 13% of the American population, and 52% of our homicides are committed by young Black men.
For years, if we've seen high rates of violence or crime in certain communities, we've said more policing, more policing, more policing. I think instead we need to continue to say more. More resources should go into those communities, but a different type of resources.
That's Scott Roberts. He says ending violence starts with solving social issues by providing resources to communities in need.
Some of the things that we need to invest in are kind of those basic things that help communities become more stable: education, housing, healthcare. We need to provide for people's survival.
The changes these protests can cause at the state level will depend on what lawmakers decide to do when they're back in session next year. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is Science in a Minute.
When stars like our sun die, they expand into a red giant as it burns through what's left of its fuel supply. As the star gets bigger and bigger, it's expected that any solar system object in its path, including planets, will be engulfed and incinerated. What remains of the star afterwards is a small, hot, and dense cinder-like core called a white dwarf. A team of astronomers using space and ground-based telescopes say they found what might be the first undamaged planet to closely orbit a white dwarf. The object, identified as WD-1856b, is Jupiter-sized, is about 7 times bigger than the white dwarf, and orbits what remains of its star once every 34 hours. The planet-like object and the white dwarf are located about 80 light-years away in the constellation Draco. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Finally today, after nearly 25-year country music career, singer Leanne Rimes is finding new ways to share her voice through a podcast and her first chant record. The Grammy Award winner meditates regularly and says she wanted to make chanting more accessible to her fans to relieve the pandemic blues. The stress caused Rimes' psoriasis to flare up, which she revealed through a picture of her skin outbreak in October in an attempt to encourage people to shed their own hang-ups. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening.